Esther 8, verses 1 and 2. On that day did the king Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. The king took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it unto Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. It has rightly been remarked that people who are very cruel are often also very cowardly. Indeed, history tends to show that cowards are the most cruel people. And as Matthew Henry has noted in his commentary, the consciousness of their cruelty actually makes them the more cowardly. Now, this trait usually appears in great reversals when those who are cruel are deprived of their platform from which they've exercised their cruelty. Behold how quickly they become cowardly, how quickly Haman's pride turns to fear when he sees the source and base of his power dissolving. How quickly that confidence that was the undergirding of his cruelty, how quickly that melts into fear. For we read that Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. Now in Oriental countries, in situations like unto that of Haman, when a man's life was hanging in the balance, the outcome was often determined by the reaction of the king. So in a situation like this, and there are notes of this in some of the ancient histories, similar situations where the king is reclined on his couch when he gets the bad news. In a situation like that, if the king remained seated upon his couch, sometimes it meant that there was a determination to spare the life of the person in question. However, it turns out that in every recorded instance we have, when the king rises quickly and withdraws from the room for a time, that it's quite certain that no good is going to come from that. That whoever is in trouble, whoever's trouble has been the provocative or trigger moment that gets the king to jump up out of his seat and leave the room, that person is doomed. In fact, this ancient practice was a common manner of condemning a man to death. And there are instances recorded even until early, I believe, in the last century in Persia of this being the case. So, in the case of the one who was the Shah of Persia, or 1923, I believe they renamed it Iran, but prior to that, sometime prior to that, there were still, in the late 19th and perhaps early 20th centuries, still instances of this, where someone is condemned to death in the manner that we see Haman being condemned in the story of Esther. And the only difference really is, if the king had only remained seated, it might have boded well. Once he saw him get up, he knew this was a problem. So, as Haman's cowardice intersects with these dismal actions of the king, which indicate his doom, his degradation is actually helped forward by his own misguided and desperate attempt to find mercy at the hand of Esther. And it may well be this. Perhaps he assumed, because Esther remained seated, that she was undeterminate in this matter. And so he thought that he might find grace if he would just fall before her and plead. But as I noted before, he does so without any indication, any manifestation of repentance. As a result, the whole scene, which was designed by Haman to be a plea for mercy, actually becomes a scene of confirmation of his guilt in the eyes of the king when he returns to the room. Haman's fear made him flee before his enemies. But his flight seems to be that of one forsaken by God as he knows the day of judgment is approaching. It's like that case that we read of in Amos 5:19, as if a man did flee from a lion and a bear met him, or went into the house and leaned his hand on the wall and a serpent bit him. Everything he's doing is just making it worse. Now, Solomon has said that it's better to be a living dog than a dead lion. Haman at this point isn't quite a dead lion, but he's not really much of a living dog either. In fact, he's really no better than a dead lion. And already we see, before he's even dead, that he's being treated as a dead lion. And so it must have struck his ears as both bitter and ironic when he hears Harbona, the chamberlain, the court eunuch, informing the king, after they'd covered Haman's face, informing him that there were gallows already erected upon which they might hang that doomed man. Now, for a man as proud as Haman, this must have caused him to chafe at the hearing of it. Hearing one who merely hours before would have done all of his bidding. Think about that. Just hours before, Harbona would have done anything that Haman had wanted him to do. Moreover, those words are set to bring him to be hanged upon the gallows, the very gallows that he'd constructed for his mortal enemy Mordecai. The picture we get at the end of the last chapter is that everything right before the execution, everything is in a free fall, and Haman is just crashing and burning at every turn, and that everything is designed to humiliate and degrade him on the way to his execution. In a few minutes at the end of that banquet, a lifetime of craft, cunning, a lifetime of plotting is dashed. And Haman discovers what cruel despots often discover only too late, that he has no real friends. And he has no real friends because the fact is this: true friendship and true fellowship can only exist between people who are themselves united to God. Every other friendship, every other fellowship is a conspiracy against the truth. It proceeds upon a ground that ignores the existence of God. And so friendship with the world is enmity with God. It's a deceitful thing. And fellowship with unbelievers is really ultimately a call to loneliness, because there can be no soul communion. Not if you're really a believer. There is in this great reversal then a great vindication of the innocence of the people of God. They've been subjected to the most wicked, the most cruel plottings by a man who had produced against them simply a bunch of vile accusations instead of proof. Now, quite often we see in the history of the church and people of God that those who persecute the righteous die in ways which have been described by those who chronicled some of this as manifestations of the justice and judgment of God. Those who are cruel persecutors of the righteous seldom die the death, the common death of all men. And in that, God vindicates the character and the reputation of his servants, often in ways which leave men without disputing who was right and who was wrong. In all of this, then, we see several truths illustrated. First of all, we are assured that in time, the foot of the sinner shall slide. A very famous text from Deuteronomy 32:35, made famous by Jonathan Edwards in his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. The text says, "To me belongeth vengeance and recompense. Their foot shall slide in due time. For the day of their calamity is at hand, and the things that shall come upon them make haste." The truth of this text is that the God who keeps Israel does not sleep, does not slumber. He stands ready, he says, to avenge those who oppose his people or their spiritual welfare. He stands ready to avenge. Sooner or later, those who find success in sin will be cast down from their pride. Sooner or later. It's natural for his people, for God's people, when they see the prosperity of the wicked, to be grieved and troubled. But like the psalmist, when they see the prosperity of the wicked, they're commanded to wait patiently to see the end of the Lord. For if we wait long enough, we shall see that sin has its appointed reward. Truly, then, their feet have been set in slippery places. Truly, then, their foot shall slide in due time, for their calamity, the day of their calamity, is at hand. So for individuals, it might not be quite so long. But in the case of nations and empires often founded in blood and usurpation, usually maintained through violence and corruption, it very often does take more time to see the end. Nevertheless, the truth remains, God shall mete out vengeance and recompense. Their foot shall slide in due time. It's the privilege and it's the duty of the church to pray that that day hasten. God has appointed that end for the wicked. And if they will not repent, then their end is just and justifiable and therefore worthy of our praying that it come and come soon. We should remember that sin carries in its bosom the seeds of its own destruction. And thus, it often takes time for these sins, seeds of sin, to be disseminated, to germinate, to grow, and bring forth their fruit. But we need to remember that the fruit of sin always is judgment. Psalm 37, verses 35 and 36, the psalmist says, "I've seen the wicked in great power, and spreading himself like a green bay tree," that is, like a tree, a living tree that's growing in its own soil. "Yet," he goes on to say, "yet he passed away and lo, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found. The soil in which the seeds of sin are planted is a soil which will not bear the ravages of the storms of the wrath of God. And so it is sowing destruction. But secondly, there's a corollary here to this first point. A corollary that in due time, the righteousness which sin attempted to overthrow and destroy will emerge triumphant. Psalm 30, verse 5, the psalmist says, "For his anger endureth but for a moment, in his favor is life. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning." We're assured in Scripture that there's great reward in keeping the laws of God. And so, purity, uprightness, integrity, kindness, all of these have within them the power of ultimate success. All of these have within them a certain kind of endurance that you will never find in sin. The wicked shall be cut off, and the time shall come when right shall be made victorious over might. And in each deliverance of the people of God in history, what we see is a picture of that final deliverance that is figured out on Judgment Day. That doesn't diminish or cheapen the temporal deliverances. Rather, it ties them to that final redemption promised. And that makes each one of them then much more precious and much more significant. Because they don't stand alone. Rather, they all stand as strung together parts of a long chain of the justice and judgment of God and the redemption of his people, appearing again and again throughout the history of mankind. Thirdly, it is notable that it's a common thing for sin to suffer from its own devisings. We saw that in a couple of the psalms that we sang earlier. Let them fall into the pit which they've digged. Let them be taken in the trap which they've devised for the righteous. And Haman is hanged upon the gallows that he's erected for Mordecai. He falls into the very trap which he's laid for the righteous. The very evil, the very cruelty that sin had contemplated for another falls upon that wicked man with a breathtaking fury and suddenness. And there is in this, for those who are inclined to God's point of view, there is a poetic quality to the justice involved. But even if sin doesn't suffer in this manner, we're assured that sin shall bear the penalty. And it's a notable fact in every sin that the chief victim and the primary sufferer from that sin is the sinner. Because every sin, every act of evil, every wicked deed corrupts the heart and hardens the sinner, so the course that they're taking becomes stronger and stronger, drawing them toward that final judgment of condemnation. Unless divine mercy intervene, there is no hope for men in that state of unbelief. It's mercy that God would intervene in the life of anyone. It's all of grace. And finally, it's notable that every good work also carries with it its reward, even a blessing. There's a blessing. There's a blessing in it. That's what God says of the church. There's a blessing in it. Give and it shall be given unto you. That's a maxim of the Savior, and a truth which promises blessing to the one who seeks to work with what is truly good. If you're interested in doing what's really good, what is real good, and not false good, then there is a blessing. Esther and Mordecai have placed themselves in great personal danger to see that good will be done to the people of God, and they have and they shall be blessed both now and forever. And so with that, let's turn to the first couple of verses here in chapter 8. On that day did the king Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther, the queen. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. On that day, the chapter here begins with a clause indicating that the narrator of Esther, again, Mordecai, almost certainly, that he's establishing a new scene in our story. Now, there's been some argument, some debate, because of its close relation to what preceded, whether or not the first two verses, particularly in this chapter, belong to the previous chapter. However, I would say this. I think that the Masoretes, or whoever came up with the chapter division here, that their instincts were correct, because the previous chapter, if read together, forms a complete unit, and it actually ends with a conclusion to the matter at hand in that chapter. Now, this chapter begins with a refocusing, which is, in fact, being set without losing sight of what just happened. Thus, the very same day on which Haman is taken out and executed is the day which is in view. And that, I think, has been the point of confusion and contention over this question. But because the storyline changes the way it does, it seems that the chapter division is, in fact, rightly made where it is. There's no break in the pace of the story, precisely because there still remains more to be done for the people of God. And that, again, may contribute to some of the confusion here as to whether or not we have two chapters or one. But the fact that what happens next transpires the same day means much of the information in the preceding chapter is quite relevant for the next series of events. And yet, this is a very separate and separable scene or act in the story. Here then, we shall see now begin, at least begin to see, the triumphing of righteousness over the designs of the wicked. Right? On that day, did the king Ahasuerus give? Now, the clause begins with the verb give, and this may come as some surprise, right, that the king, on the same day, and really, I think if read in context, immediately following upon Haman's execution, that the king is in a giving mood. However, we should recall that once Haman, we were told Haman had been hanged, we were also told that the king's wrath was pacified or quieted. So the execution of Haman seems to have led to a very different atmosphere in the palace. A lot of the tension that had been building since at least the night before when the king couldn't sleep, a lot of that tension has been drawn out. A lot of the anticipation, you know, knowing as we're reading and seeing where this is going, a lot of that is drawn out. We're actually at a point where, after a climax of epic proportion, the story was not so well known, it might be almost breathtaking in its conclusion at the end of the previous chapter when Haman is taken the way he is. That at the end of that, we have a moment to take a deep breath and to consider. So I think that reflects the attitude and the actions of the king here. It seems as if, as his anger abates, Ahasuerus begins to realize that although he's just had Haman executed, he really hasn't done anything tangible to fulfill his promise to give Esther up to half of the kingdom, has he? I mean, it's not really something. Having Haman executed is not something, at least in a positive sense. It's not really, perhaps, even what the king had in mind when he was offering some sort of bountiful gift to Esther. Now, again, I would suggest that the price that he's about to give to the queen has been determined in his mind by the gods or the fates. And I'm going to explain why. But I think that there's something to this. And he still thinks, I mean, he's still a heathen. And he's still thinking in that heathenish fashion that is almost fatalistic. So, did the king give the house of Haman? Now, the Targums here, which are the interpretive texts surrounding the Book of Esther, the ancient rabbinic interpretive texts, and I've referred to them from time to time. The Targums understand by the term house to mean all the people, probably including the family of Haman, all the property, all the treasures, the riches, everything which pertained to Haman. Now, according to the law of Ishit, which is still, it's part of jurisprudence, I think, everywhere in the world. The notion is this, that a person dying without legal heirs suffers the property of the estate to revert to the crown, to the state. In Persia, as in other ancient cultures, traitors such as Haman, he's certainly viewed as a traitor here, traitors such as Haman forfeited their estates to the crown. Now, both Herodotus in his histories and later Josephus in his antiquities, so we have a Gentile and a Jew writing histories of antiquities, both of them state that the property of criminals was confiscated by the state upon their execution. So this is not an unusual thing. What is interesting is this. Keep in mind the way I'm suggesting the king has been thinking. Had the king been wondering what he could give Esther, all of a sudden, the gift seems to be defined by the course of fate. Right? He didn't know exactly how much of the kingdom to give. But now, there is a well-defined chunk of the kingdom that has become available through execution. What more appropriate, after all, could form the bestowal than the estate of one who had threatened her and her people? Think about it. You know, in from the point of view of the king, all of this seems just, it just seems to be harmonious. It seems to have that sense of cosmic harmony wrapped around it. It feels like the right thing to do if you're a heathen king. You know, this all seems to be fitting together quite well. Moreover, we should keep in mind that in the kingdom of Persia, the will of the king, or the Shah of Persia, he's a despot, he's an arbitrary ruler, and his will is law. So, when the text says he's giving, it really means he's bestowing a legal right to that house and property. And this is an important thing to keep in mind. It distinguishes this from what we're going to see in verse 2, Esther does with the property with regard to Mordecai. It should also be remembered that in Oriental cultures, especially in ancient times, the servants of the king possess whatever it is they have through him and at his pleasure. So Haman really loses this two ways. He's a creature of the court, and he's now a traitor. So the king could have just called this back, but he has a good reason to. He's now executed him. So it's really, there's almost a confirmation that this is the proper amount to give to Esther. You know, if you're a heathen king and you're looking for some sign from the heavens, from the fates, from the gods, this is about as good as it's going to get for you. And so with Haman's punishment, everything is returned to him, and it seems like that neat package. And so we're told he gave the house of Haman the Jews' enemy. Now it's notable that this title, the Jews' enemy, has become what I think we can only really call the official designation of Haman, as is going to appear later in the book, particularly in chapter 9. You should recall the word enemy refers to one who attacks with hostility. There's a hostile intent. And it suggests that everything he did was moved by an implacable hatred for the people of God, and ultimately, behind that is a hatred for God. So every time you hear that, you should be thinking, this is an enemy of God to his people. Right? This is what got him into trouble. This is what led to his destruction. He is the enemy of God and his people. Although, again, we know the name of God is never mentioned. God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. But just mentioning the Jews should bring to mind God. Now, the use of this name, as they say, serves to remind us why he met his defeat, but it also, I think, serves to warn us, as we're reading, that we don't place ourselves in that category of people. Right? I mean, when you say the Jews' enemy, you're now taking Haman and you're making him a category into which it's possible for me to fall as well. And if it only said Haman, you wouldn't be constrained to ask yourself, am I also an enemy of the Jews or the God of the Jews? By saying the Jews' enemy, it forces that question upon you. Not only is it telling you this is a road to ruin, but you should consider whether or not you're on that road. So did the king Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen? Again, interestingly, the king doesn't confiscate Haman's house for himself, but he does so to turn it over to Esther, whom he undoubtedly felt had been wronged in this whole episode. It seems like the more he discovers, the more he's offended, and while I'm not so sure that he's offended for the Jews per se, he certainly is at least offended for Esther. You know, he has a certain affection for Esther, so he's offended. By the way, this situation illustrates what Solomon says in Proverbs 13:22, a good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just. Esther now has control over Haman's entire estate, probably, almost certainly, I would add, including his family. And in this reversal, we should consider that property is really only to be valued as it's used. Right? Haman has used this property for ill purposes, to persecute the church and people of God. Esther will put all of Haman's property, including his family, to a better use than Haman ever would. And that means that the value of the property will actually increase. Haman meant to use it to wreak havoc. She's going to use it to save the people of God and restore the honor of the king with regard to this whole matter. And so the king gave the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen. And then we read, and Mordecai came before the king. Now this is a very interesting phrase. The phrase here indicates that Mordecai was advanced to the rank of those high court officials who were permitted to see the king face to face. That's what it really means. Not many people were allowed to see the king face to face. Certainly not in an informal or less formal setting than that period of time when he was seated upon the throne entertaining people who had been summoned. The fact is, Mordecai had been honored as a benefactor of the king earlier in the day, but now he actually finds himself being taken into the court. That hadn't happened earlier. So here again, we see the fruit of Haman's self-destruction. Now, the fact that he couldn't see himself as that most noble ruler next to the king, he didn't perceive that in himself. So he asked that the most noble ruler would be the one that would lead the man that the king desired to honor throughout the streets, and he ended up doing it. Now, it appears, and as it goes on, we'll see it is clear, Mordecai is going to take Haman's place in the court. There's a sense in which then we can see the procession through the streets, no pun intended, but it had paved the way for his elevation without further embarrassment or trouble to the king. Again, from the king's perspective, all of this must seem to be falling into place as so many pieces of a puzzle, right? Just all seems to be making more and more sense. It all fits together on this end. It must appear to him to be the confirmation of fate that these destinies of Esther and Mordecai seem to conform to the desire to see justice by restoring the balance of equity in his kingdom. Remember, that's why he couldn't sleep. Something is wrong. Now, as he's trying to restore this sense of equity and justice through the kingdom, it just seems like all the pieces are lining up and falling into place, doesn't it? Not only was Haman gone, but his execution has left a vacancy in the royal court. And who better to give that position than the man that he had discovered earlier in the day, or recalled earlier in the day, was the man who had saved his life. And yet, this is not his only consideration for elevating Mordecai. Because we're told the next clause, for Esther had told what he was unto her. Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. In other words, he came before the king because of what Esther told the king. So we learn that Esther not only revealed that she was a Jewess and of the nation of Mordecai, but now, finally, we're told she revealed to Ahasuerus her precise relation to Mordecai. Who is he? He's her cousin. That's pretty close, but there's more to the story, isn't there? More importantly, if you're Ahasuerus, you're gonna be interested in this story, because from her point of view, he's assumed a much more important role in her life than just cousin. He had taken her in as an orphan when her parents had died. He'd raised her to be the woman that the king now so loved. So, in contrast to Haman, I should say, Mordecai actually emerges here as a very modest and an unassuming man. And I say that because he made no use of his relation to the queen for his own personal aggrandizement. He could have. But he never played the nepotism card. And that at a time when nepotism really counted for something. Being related to someone in these ancient courts, that was the next best thing to being the person in question, you know, Esther. Remember, again, the king's will is law. So it doesn't really matter to him at all that Mordecai is a Jew. What matters to him is this. He's related to Esther, that she's extremely fond of him, that she trusted him, and that he was one who had already obtained his favor. Right? He'd actually obtained favor independent. So again, this is confirmation to the king. Combined with great favor he had toward Esther, it should be easy then to understand why this seemed to be an obvious choice for Ahasuerus. Now, one commentator noted at this point that he really wished that whatever Esther had said had been recorded in the story, because it must have been a wonderful thing. But it's not said. Like so many things in the book of Esther, what's good, what's holy, is left unsaid. You know, God is, in a sense, silent in the book. And what is evil is, in fact, spoken out loud. What Esther understands, I think, is this, though. Now is the proper time to reveal this information. At an earlier time, had she done it, it might have been prejudicial to the cause of the Jews. And if she didn't make this plain now with Haman out of the way, further concealment might appear prejudicial to the crown at a later date. You know, like, why didn't you tell me? Now that you could tell me. Now that that wicked guy's out of the way. So if it had been exposed by someone else later on, it probably wouldn't have had the same effect upon the deportment of the king. There's a time to speak and a time to remain silent, and Esther speaks at the right time to this matter. I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes, but I think that that's something worth thinking about, and I want to think about that a little bit more after we go through the next verse. Verse 2. And the king took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it unto Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. And the king took off his ring. By ring, what is clearly meant here is signet ring, his signet ring. The ring that was used to seal all official documents. The ring, which was a sign of the presence of the king. The ring's important because it signifies the power and authority of the throne. So with this ring, a faithful courtier of the stature of Haman and now of Mordecai, one who's assumed the role of prime minister, grand vizier, one in that position could rule very well. If you're faithful. Of course, if you're unfaithful, really more like Haman, you can cause destruction and distress. You can do all kinds of harm and cause all kinds of havoc. It's important this ring is important because this is a ring that was used to seal the decrees sent into the whole kingdom, calling for the destruction of all the Jews. It's therefore purposeful that our attention is turned once more to the ring. Right. It's true that Haman, the enemy of the Jews, has been executed. And the immediate threat to the life of Mordecai, the prophet of the Jews, has been foiled. However, we need to remember this. Haman's edict to exterminate the Jews in that great Holocaust that he's planning, which had been transcribed into all the languages of the kingdom, that has not been reversed. There's an impending danger still. Now, what if, as we've been told, the laws of the Medes and Persians cannot be changed? Then all of this which has transpired thus far might seem to be in vain. We really don't know yet, but bringing this ring back into the picture suggests that it not only had something to do with the wicked edict, but that it may play a part in the solution to bring much-needed relief and salvation to the Jews. So it's significant here that this comes back into the center of the story. The king took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman. We're not told when, but I think we can surmise it must have been around the time they covered Haman's face and let him out to be executed. I say that because I think that if the king had removed it earlier than that, for example, when Haman was made to lead Mordecai around the street, I think Haman would very likely have complained bitterly about its loss when he returned home, and he doesn't mention that. You see, Haman would have understood what it meant to be entrusted with a signet ring, and so he would have understood its removal would have assured him nothing good could follow from that. In fact, if the ring had been removed, you've got to wonder if he would have even showed up at that second banquet. You know, it seems that he showed up at that second banquet precisely because he perceived there to be some possible benefit to himself. He gave it, the ring that he's taken from him, and he gives to Mordecai. The ring in the context of the court was, in fact, a ring normally bestowed upon the Grand Vizier, or what we might call the Prime Minister, the one who served as the highest and most trusted counselor to the king, which is why we're told now, and he gave it to Mordecai. What this means is Mordecai now takes the place of Haman in the court. Right, the one who persecuted had fallen, and the one persecuted now comes to power. And this story of Mordecai replacing Haman is actually a somewhat common theme if you read in ancient histories chronicling the activities among the Oriental despots, the Oriental tyrannies. It is not at all strange that upon the fall of one faction from court favor into disfavor, that the contending parties elevated into favor vacated by the fall of the former party. Right? What's interesting, I think, is this. In ancient courts, it was actually viewed, that rise and fall was actually viewed as a sign of the absolute authority of the despot, the Shah, the king. Because he could dispose favor or remove favor at his will. In Western democracies, we have a similar thing when one party goes in or out of power. where there is a spoils system where something similar happens, that there is a removal of people from the other party and their replacement with people from the party now in favor of the people, the party that's been elected to power. It's interesting that the very thing that was viewed as a sign of power among these ancient tyrants has become a symbol of the limitation of power in a democracy. It's actually assumed a very different role. And so it may be hard for us to understand that part of the equation here. We see then all the trust and power that have been vested in Haman is turned over to Mordecai by the king. And again, the king's will is law. But this time, in doing so, we know the king is placing his trust in a man who's demonstrated a disinterestedness in personal ambition coupled with an unswerving devotion to his beloved queen. Which he's taken from Haman, gave it unto Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now, it wouldn't have seemed proper for Esther to gift the house of Haman to Mordecai after the king had just given her legal right to it. So the word which is used here means that she set Mordecai over the estate as one with authority to dispose of it. She didn't give him legal right to it per se. It remained hers, but she indicates by this that she wishes him to show her how to make proper use of it. And in doing this, Esther reminds us of the need for godly counsel in the disposal of all of our goods and property, even in this life. She is aware that she needs counsel. I want to make a few observations before I close this section of chapter 8. In the reversals of the day, I want to suggest that there are two very interesting themes. First, if we consider the case of the king, we see a man stricken in conscience. And we come to see that the affairs of the conscience are best served by first thoughts. After a sleepless night, the king is concerned to do what's right, to mend a gnawing conscience. Moved by a conscience now tender to rectify misdeeds and other moral failings, what does he do? He strikes quickly as each thought presents itself. That's true, his actions are not necessarily prudent, but he's serving a higher purpose unbeknownst to himself. He's being led by a secret providence to secure the well-being of the church. And that requires a right conscience. And so it's interesting that his conscience is being moved by first thoughts all the time. That's true. In matters of conscience, sometimes deliberation may be necessary, especially because men do not often know how far their consciences have been or have not been enlightened by the Word and Spirit. And yet, more often, in matters of conscience, hesitation to respond is a sign not that you have a tender conscience, but that you're searing your conscience. Here is a king with an erring conscience, seeking to set right things that have been left undone or done amiss. And through the providence of God, whether he recognizes that quite for what it is or not, in the reading of the book and later at the banquets of the queen, whatever was lacking in information that was needed for his conscience to function properly was filled up so that his conscience was able to function correctly to establish equity. Now, second, in the case of Esther and Mordecai, we see an illustration of the principle that in matters of prudence or matters of careful judgment, first thoughts are often not the best, but second thoughts. How many times have you heard somebody say, on second thought, let me do X? Throughout the story, notice Esther and Mordecai move cautiously or prudently in their approach. It's true they fast and they pray, but they also do not cast all caution to the wind. They are, after all, not fatalists, but as we're going to see, they're predestinarians. Right? Deliverance will come, but precisely how, they know they need to wait and see. And unlike Haman, who is constantly acting impulsively and to his own destruction, Esther and Mordecai act faithfully and prudently with an eye to the glory of God and the good of his people. So on this day, the king not only discovers that Esther is his beloved queen, but more importantly, he discovers her to be a virtuous and sensible woman. Unlike Haman, who sought wealth and power for his own selfish purposes, Esther didn't seek wealth or power, but finding it, she seeks to use it, especially her temporal advantages, for the good of others, especially the church. And therefore, when the house of Haman is bestowed upon her as a gift befitting a queen, she is quick to see that it will be turned to the benefit of the church and people of God. On this day, Esther stands to make a confession to the king regarding her relation to Mordecai. She doesn't do so because of fear, but now, as I noted earlier, there's a sense of gratitude. Moreover, it's a sense of gratitude to the king and to Mordecai. She perceives in the king not only his deep love for her, but his kind disposition toward her. And with the removal of Haman, the truth could be told, and the king could relish the realization that Mordecai was not only related by blood, but was even as a father unto Esther. And this, of course, could only be further confirmation to him that he's moving along that right track, that he's repairing that cosmic rift that he feared troubled him in his kingdom, that had kept him awake the night before. Additionally, Esther heaps glorious praise upon Mordecai, honoring him for all that he'd done for her and elevating his stature in the eyes of the king. In Esther's example, we can see the blessing of acknowledging our indebtedness to the services of others on our behalf. You see, gratitude to benefactors is essential to a virtuous character. The fact is this: there's nothing worse that you can call a man than when you call him ungrateful. Saying that a man is ungrateful is to say that he is everything base, bad, and unworthy of human society. Ungrateful men do not belong in the society and communion of mankind. On this day, the king demonstrated his fairness and concern for justice, didn't he? Who could or should the king delight to honor more than this man, Mordecai? Here was a man who had rendered great service to the king. Here was a man who was a benefactor of the crown. Here was a man of trust whose management of affairs is now revealed to be with consummate wisdom. And though there was some inequity in that he had to wait so long for this to be recognized, the fact was it was conferred in his lifetime. Of course, we know this is not always the case among men. Very often men do not live long enough to see that others recognize their true worth. They're like the proverbial artist whose paintings never seem to be worth much during their lives. Righteous men and those who are standing askance at history, asking what is going on, what many perceive to be the course of the right flow of history, those kinds of men are only appreciated when they lie quietly in their graves. Now, should we wait for the recognition that this is due to us if we live righteously in this life, if we make a stand for the truth against the tide of current lies? It's very likely that we will only find disappointment. Scripture teaches us that the only waiting that's not going to end in disappointment is when we quietly, hopefully, and earnestly set ourselves to do the work of the Lord, not in hope of some present glory, but rather in hope of that eternal glory, that crown that waits for those who trust in Jesus. On this day, Esther sees the best proof she has yet seen of Mordecai's wisdom, hasn't she? It's brought him to the attention of the king and into the very court of the king. Finally, it set him beside the king in the affairs of the kingdom. And so, though she's not necessarily at liberty to give Mordecai Haman's house, she does see clearly that it's best to make him the steward of it. And in this way, she can assure that everything would be turned to the advantage of all for whom it would be necessary. In Mordecai, we see that God sometimes does promote men to places of power and trust in nations, even though they're godly. Indeed, we have hope that the day is coming very soon when this will not be an exception, but will actually become the rule. But those men, when they're elevated to such positions, are to remember that they're promoted to that place of power and trust for the good and comfort of the church and people of God. And if they do not exercise themselves with regard to that, they provoke the wrath of God. Now, interestingly, the king had never considered that the whole affair was not yet over with the hanging of Haman. He knew now that there had been some controversy between his beloved queen and his minister Haman. And for the moment, the reason for Haman's fall was that Ahasuerus had perceived him to be a threat to his own sovereignty. He'd attacked the king's crown. He'd attacked the king's wife from his perspective. And he'd been executed for that affront. But the king had not really killed him for the sake of the Jews. His anger was not because Haman had decreed the death of the Jewish nation. His anger was because he felt his own authority was under assault from his prime minister. And this is confirmed to him by Haman's behavior before the couch of the queen. That's why the death of Haman was said to appease his wrath or satisfy his anger. He thought it was all at an end. The problem is this: neither the queen nor Mordecai could be satisfied with the fall of Haman. After all, she and Mordecai hadn't done what they had done, and she hadn't risked her life coming before the throne unannounced, merely in order to see Haman hanged. They were seeking the deliverance of Israel. And so, as good a thing as it is that Mordecai now sits in Haman's seat and has the ring and even is steward over the house of Haman, nothing will satisfy until the church and people of God are saved. The problem, as we shall see, is that Haman's death does not nullify the decree or edict against the Jews. And so Esther is going to have to speak again. Now, in conclusion, I just want to note, the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 55:13 says, Instead of the thorn shall come up the fir tree, and instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle tree. And it shall be to the Lord for a name, for an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off. The rabbis, commenting on this verse, say that Haman was that thorn. He was like a thorn because he had nothing good or useful coming from him, like a thorn. Instead of him shall come up a fir tree or a cypress or juniper. Now this is a species of plant, the juniper, which is found throughout the desert and provides protection from the elements for the traveler. It was also a source of fuel and, in cases of necessity, even food. The tree signified was likened by the rabbis unto Mordecai. Instead of the thorn shall come up the fir tree, or the juniper. The idea in this place, according to the rabbis, is that a harmful plant would be replaced by something beautiful and useful. And so it goes on, instead of the briar or stinging nettle, which they understood to refer to Vashti, another useless planting, this should give way to the myrtle tree, Hadas, which they believed signified Esther. Remember her name? Hadassah. Her name means a myrtle branch. And so this transition from thorns to aromatic plants is said to be for the Lord for a name or a memorial. Moreover, it's said here to be an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off, and that, according to the rabbis, is the mitzvah or the commandment for the keeping of Purim. Now, whatever we might think of the rabbinic interpretation, surely we can see that instead of thorns and briars, there are useful and beautiful plants arising in their place in this story. But we should remember that just as Christ is fulfilling the typologies of the Old Testament, just as he's the fulfillment of Passover, he's the fulfillment of Purim. And so if these are indeed to be viewed as comments aimed at Esther, the everlasting sign that shall not be cut off is not the Feast of Purim, which we will discuss, but it is, in fact, our Savior, Jesus Christ, who the Jews to this day deny to be the Messiah. But of that, more later. Amen.